This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, we are airing a campus community panel discussion from earlier this spring looking at the Me Too movement, and in particular, what the future holds for the movement. Moderating today's panel is Cynthia Berg, Dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Science and professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Utah. Here she is now to introduce today's panelists and to provide some additional context.
Great, well, thanks. I'm delighted to introduce today's theme of Me Too, Now What? And before I introduce our panelists, I want to provide just a little bit of context for today's topic. As you all know, in 2006, Tarana Burke founded the Me Too movement to help survivors of sexual violence, especially women of color who were of low income, to find a pathway back to health through empathy. And in October 2017, this movement spread virally as a hashtag on social media, used by about 4.7 million people on Facebook during the first 24 hours. And this created, I think, a revival of that conversation, with some arguing, how could this experience be so common? And I think people like myself asked, how could it not be more common and really experienced by almost every female in the United States? This was soon followed by very public revelations of sexual misconduct against many in the entertainment industry, including Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer, and many others. And the widespread nature of sexual misconduct has reached, I think, every corner of our society, from the corporate workplace to universities, government offices, and even our churches. And this movement has brought the conversation into the public discourse much more broadly. By this year, the Silence Breakers being named Times Magazine of the Year. If we look at the estimates of prevalence of sexual violence by the World Health Organization, it is that some one-third of women are affected worldwide. A 2017 poll by ABC News and the Washington Post found that about 54% of women receive unwanted and inappropriate sexual advances, with the vast majority of those being unpunished. And we are not immune to that problem here in Utah, where the Utah Women in Leadership Project, led by Susan Mattson at Utah Valley University, indicated that one in three Utah women will experience some form of domestic violence in her lifetime, with Utah's rate slightly above the national average. The conversation of sexual violence and harassment is really now alive more than ever before, and this has reached nearly every part of our lives. We're questioning how we are supposed to interact at work. The New York Times did a series right around the holidays. Should we have holiday parties? Do we know how to interact with each other? And also how we educate our children so that new social norms can be set. I'm delighted to introduce today's panelists, who I know will move us forward in really very interesting and important ways. First, I'd like to introduce Ella Myers, right here to my left, Associate Professor of Political Science and Gender Studies. Dr. Myers is an award-winning teacher of political and feminist theory. Her courses include Contemporary Political Theory, Economic Inequality and Democracy, Feminist Political Theory, and Gender. Her research focuses on the distribution of political power and practices of collective resistance through which ordinary citizens strive to shape their work. And I'm really looking forward to her comments on how the Me Too movement has been part of this conversation. Next, we have Bev Wiepe, City Councilman for the Mill Creek City Council. She started the Mill Creek Community Center and, as an elected official, is currently working to set Mill Creek up with successful contracts, maximizing economic development opportunities and addressing things such as land use concerns and conducting transparent budgeting processes. She's our own alum, earning an executive master's in public administration from the University of Utah in 2015. And a part of Bev's campaign as a councilwoman has been to advocate for women, minorities, and diverse family structures, including single mother and father households. She's been at the forefront of mentoring and inspiring women and minorities to get involved in leadership positions, and was the first Pacific Islander woman elected to an office in the state of Utah. So congratulations. And Michelle Quist, editorial writer for the Salt Lake Tribune. She had attended undergraduate and law school at Brigham Young University. She's worked at law firms, clerk on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and was the dean of admissions at BYU Law School before entering private practice as an appellate attorney. She's actively involved in Real Women Run and the Family Advisory Council at Primary Children's Medical Center. And Michelle has written extensively in the Trib about issues important to women, including the value of women in politics, sexual harassment that occurs in the Utah legislature, and that domestic violence is a problem really for all institutions, including the LDS Church. A key part of this panel is that they were asked to address two questions that we felt would be great to guide the dialogue on the Me Too movement. First, what lessons have been learned and what still remains to be learned from the Me Too movement? And then to help achieve gender and sexual equality in our society, what new directions should this movement take? And how can we all as participants attending this dialogue help? As you heard, we will have each of them speak for about 6 to 8 minutes, and then we'll have the opportunity for you to ask questions with a time for them to wrap up as well. So with that, I will let you go ahead and start, Professor Myers.
So it's great to see all of you here today, and I'm really happy to be participating in this conversation. So I wanted to start reflecting on the Me Too phenomenon by looking at the phrase itself for a second. So the hashtag, the slogan, the specific words that have by now become the name of a movement. So I think the Me Too phrase is interesting in part because it operates on at least two different registers. So I think the easiest piece of it to see is that the refrain Me Too, when it's repeated over and over again to signal that the speaker has experienced sexual harassment and or sexual assault, has the cumulative effect of demonstrating how widespread these problems are. So it tries to sort of communicate a sense of scale to anyone who is in need of convincing. But at the same time, the utterance Me Too also aims at creating solidarity among the victims, survivors of these violations. That is, the statement is not only directed broadly to any and all members of society, but it also invites connection among women in response to abuse that routinely isolates and silences its targets. So in these two ways, although Me Too is very much a product of the digital age, it also enacts the familiar adage of the second wave feminist movement, the personal is political. So in the phrase Me Too, the insistently personal quality of the me is paired with the implicit recognition that one is not alone, me too. And the effect of many, many Me Toos and the narratives that accompany them is to insist, just as other feminist dissidents have before, that what appears to be a personal or even private experience is in fact nothing of the sort. Me Too makes sexual abuse in its many forms legible as a political problem of the first order. So I want to say a little bit now about what I think the sort of the power is in this phenomenon. So I don't really think it resides in any single story of misconduct, nor do I think it even really resides in the sort of obscene tally of these many, many stories of misconduct. I think that the story's real impacts come from the glimpse they give us of patterns of systemic inequity. So if you think about the narratives that have been circulating in popular culture recently, some of what Dean Berg just mentioned, from the most well-publicized accounts of predation by male celebrities to the stories that are just beginning now to be publicized that originate in less elite social spaces, the countless testimonials of abuse endured by women working in restaurants, on farms, in private homes, in factories. These stories en masse help bring into view what we might call the infrastructure of gender injustice. More specifically, I think the Me Too movement helps to expose and to publicly reject a pervasive, dangerous, gendered form of entitlement, one which presumes a male right of access to women. So to deepen this point, I want to mention an idea from the feminist theorist Carol Pateman. And she's argued that the notion of the social contract, which is so central to the self-understanding of lots of liberal democratic societies, especially our own, that idea of the social contract actually serves to conceal a sexual contract that founds and sustains our society. In other words, the myth of a social contract entered into by free and equal individuals is a cover for what is actually a fraternal social contract or a domination contract. The compact that founded modern polities, whether actually or symbolically, Pateman argues, was a compact among men. And the contract granted to men two significant things. First, a monopoly on political power from which women were excluded, and second, a sexual right to women's bodies. Most provocatively, Pateman maintains that this fraternal social contract is not a historical artifact, but remains with us, albeit in a revised form. If Pateman is right about this, and I happen to think she is, then we might regard the Me Too movement as one of many efforts that have taken place over centuries to weaken the fraternal social contract. More pointedly, Me Too rejects a key pillar of that contract, men's right to women, to women's bodies, but also to their attention, affection, and interest. Me Too, at its best, rejects this conceit and lays claim to women's jurisdiction over themselves, whether on the street, at home, in school, or at work. So now to sort of turn to what I think remains to be learned and how we can continue to push for equality. First, we have to prioritize the stories of women who are not white, wealthy, and professional. Many smart commentators have pointed out that the Me Too stories that have been most visible in media coverage are those told by relatively affluent white women in elite professions. The experiences of poorer women and women of color less often gain public attention or elicit outrage. Yet, for example, levels of sexual harassment and sexual assault are highest in the restaurant industry, and across all industries, women who perform low-wage work and women who are undocumented are particularly vulnerable. Their stories are beginning to get some attention, but those committed to the cause of gender equality must seek out, listen to, and amplify the voices of women who do not enjoy race, class, and citizenship privileges. Second, I think there's something to be learned from the attempts to dismiss or discredit Me Too participants. And what still needs to be recognized on that front is how patriarchal culture conditions its members of whatever gender to prioritize the interests and wishes of men. We can see just how ingrained the tendency is if we consider a style of response that I'm sure all of you in this room have heard. And it takes the form of a lament over the fates of those men who have been fired or pushed to resign in the wake of serious allegations of harassment and assault. And I want to suggest that the worry and concern directed at men and their lost jobs and broken careers is an indication of just how effectively we have been taught to direct our sympathy and concern toward men and to exonerate their bad behavior. This default patriarchal habit is what the feminist philosopher Kate Mann has called himpathy. I think himpathy is quite evident in public discussions of sexual abuse that Me Too has helped initiate. And I actually have another point about this, and maybe I'll come back to it in the Q&A if people are interested, but I actually think the recurrent invocation of due process in the context of widespread systemic sexual violence is an attempt to recenter men and their concerns. And finally, to conclude, I just want to say something brief about the aims that might guide us in future fights for gender equality. I don't really like prescriptions of this sort, I have to say. I actually think one of the most heartening and exciting dimensions of social movements is the unexpected ways that new voices and new actors appear on the political stage in ways people couldn't have predicted. Obviously, the most recent clear example of that is the emergence of high school students as political leaders of a mass movement that did not exist 3 months ago. And I think Me Too, though arguably a long time in coming, was also not a legible phenomenon just 1 year ago. So I'm a little hesitant to predict what's to come or to stipulate a program of action. But I will say that I think any lasting change on behalf of gender equality will require much more than punishing individual men. It will require people of all genders who are committed to dismantling the fraternal social contract within which we still live. And it will require targeting both components of that contract, the presumption of a masculine right of access to women and the de facto authority men still hold to construct the world we all must live in. So the task is big. It's about nothing less than contesting men's unjust, disproportionate claim to every kind of power in the public and professional world. Thank you.
So my intro kind of actually goes along the same lines. You know, what is the Me Too movement, or why was it started, or how was it started? The purpose was to bring awareness to the pervasiveness of the movement. You know, we heard that at least 4 million people have used the hashtag on Facebook, yet at least 1 in 3, you know, participate or are victims of domestic violence. That's a lot more than 4 million. So you can see how many people are still silenced by the fear and shame of things that happen to them. For most women, harassment is a way of life. Assault isn't necessarily, but harassment is in this regards. The glass ceilings that we've encountered in employment, jokes, innuendo, catcalls on the street, parking under lights. Who does that at night? Do men park under lights at night in parking lots? Hold, you know, being trained to walk with your keys facing out. You know, that's a definite gendered training, carrying mace, all of that stuff. Women are always and constantly sexualized, or they have been, men are not. And so this Me Too movement has started the conversation, the discussion around sexual harassment, sexual abuse, domestic violence, and now recently here in Utah especially, church-related abuse or other scenarios where there's an authoritative relationship and there's a break in that relationship. The Pew organization actually just came out with a report this week. And I wanted to note two things that it showed. It basically shows the impact of the movement depends on race, age, gender. Slightly more than half of the people surveyed, 51%, said the heightened focus on sexual harassment in the workplace has created new challenges for men at work. Men were more likely to hold this belief, 55%, than women, 47%. And the report also showed two-thirds of respondents older than 65 thought gender relations at work seem more difficult in wake of the accusations piling up against powerful men, compared with 52% of people ages 50 to 64 and 42% of those younger than 30. So obviously the different generations are taking this movement differently. But who's still in power and in control in employment situations or in government situations or in school situations? It's the older generation that are taking this movement in differently than the younger generation is. What are some of the proposed solutions that we've seen, specifically here in Utah, for the Me Too harassment? Most people agree that this is obviously a problem, and they don't want to, they don't want it to grow. And so they've tried to think up these solutions. Some of them have been a commitment to interview at least one woman for high-level jobs. Okay, that's not enough. It's not going to work if you just interview one woman, especially now if you've created a limit that you only have to meet. That there's another study that shows if you only interview one, you have less of a chance of actually hiring that woman. Not taking women on business lunches. Okay. That's not going to help either. The focus should be more on not harassing women when they're on a business lunch, not excluding them from the business lunch altogether, because obviously that affects their opportunity and their involvement and engagement. And then at the legislature this past session, at least one or two male legislators were requesting only male interns. Okay, that's illegal. So that's probably not a good solution either. So the solution shouldn't be on protecting yourself from being accused. The solution needs to be not behaving that way in the first place. So I'm going to finish this way. I read today, actually, yesterday, an article by Darius Gray on healing race relations, actually, in the LDS Church. And I would be happy to talk about the community and the LDS Church issue later in questioning if you're interested. But Darius Gray, who is a founding member of the Genesis Group, gave these four solutions to healing racial wounds, and I think it was actually very pertinent to what we're discussing today. He said, first, acknowledge the problem. A lot of people still need to acknowledge the problem. Second, recognize how you are behaving that way. It's been very interesting and very surprising for some friends that I know that are male to be told that some of their behavior is considered harassing. But it is, and you need to reflect on what you're doing, and women as well need to reflect on what they're doing to exacerbate the problem. Number third was learn a new approach. You know, instead of not asking women for business lunches, learn a new approach. And four, listen. And I would add to this, listen and believe. And I'll leave it at that for now. Thanks.
Good afternoon. First of all, I want to thank Dean Berg and colleagues who've set this space up for us to be here. I'm extremely honored to be up here amongst some wonderful leaders here in our community. I'm probably not going to tell as great a story as these two have, but I'm going to talk about maybe my path and maybe my story. In 2011, I believe it was the Des News, did a story on me in a capacity well before I thought that I could ever really be a leader or run for office. And in that article in 2011, that was it seems like a long time ago, but it wasn't. And I had made a comment to talk about the fact that I had gotten myself out of a very violent relationship. And that wasn't easy back then. It's not to say that it's easier now, but it's to say that it happens, and it's happened over time. I'm also part of in the middle of a generation that comes from a culture where things had remained private. These are private family matters. So the disappointment maybe that I thought I had given my parents and my family was extremely overwhelming. Learning how to navigate what that looks like to still show up to work. And at the time, I had worked for Mayor Caroon. And in 2011, it was 7 years after I left this abusive relationship. The best thing that has come out of that abusive relationship is that it fueled me, if anything, to find spaces where I can help educate, where I can make a difference, change policy, build my own self-confidence, because there's nothing worse than being in a situation where you're trying to fix it and it's not fixed, because it had not really anything to do with me at the time. But the best thing that came out of that is now my 14-year-old son, Zane. I'm extremely proud of him, so I have big shoes to fill as both mom and dad. But what I have learned is that I'm now a huge part of raising a man. And so understanding what I have gone through has helped me, and I'm probably overly pushing his manhood, because I don't want chivalry to die. I want him to open doors. I want him to be able to be safe when he gets older to give a woman a compliment without having fear. So in this, and maybe with that statement, what I would like to maybe gather some solutions from different generations is how can we find common ground of different levels of engagement of Me Too. So there are some within cultures that really want to come out and share their story, but because of the family dynamics might not allow that, or might not allow a safe space to stay within a family of support. Is there other ways to define Me Too for those who have survived or for those who are currently going through it? I'm sure there is. And there's no way to say that there's a low, moderate, or high level of engagement for Me Too, but it could be. It could be waiting for somebody who's not comfortable enough to share their story. It took me 7 years to share my story. And then it's taken me, you know, this much time to actually use it to strengthen everything that I stand for. Dean Berg mentioned in my introduction that I wanted to run and represent a voice for diverse family structures. And it wasn't just for single moms, it was also for two dads. If you have two dads, if you have two moms in your family and that's who you're being raised by, we should find ways of having conversations within our community to accept difference. I'm also gonna talk about maybe my first work experience. So I am gonna tell you how old I am. I'm 42 this year, in next month. And when I was 22, I had worked for a private company, and I was the youngest female, I think, across the country at the time to be a junior consultant for the company. I still love the company. I still keep in touch with all my colleagues, but I think the fear of having a young woman join an older male consulting team, I walked into a meeting and a gentleman who's supposed to be my colleague looked over and said, "This." And by the way, this is at a time where pantyhose—they did professional training classes for us, where pantyhose. If you're gonna, you should wear pantyhose. If you wear skirts, heels, red lipstick, red finger. I mean, there's a whole formula of what professionalism looks like for a woman. And as I walked into this meeting, he said, "Looks like you shaved your legs today," because I didn't wear pantyhose. And I will tell you, my response should be funnier, but I did turn to him and I said, with your mother's razor. Because I just thought, if you're gonna throw it at me, you should be able to take it. I was 22, fearless. I don't know that I would say that necessarily now in a workplace. But that was the first time I had ever experienced maybe just being demeaned or, you know, not feeling supported. The funny thing is, because I was able to hold my own in that meeting, those men became the men that pushed me in my career. They gave me the space to show what my qualifications were. They were open to new ideas. And so I want to also make a statement in that there are many men out there who are here and here to support. And we should use that as part of a solution to find who those men are. And I say men because I was very much raised by uncles and my dad, who's been my supporter since day one. And I will tell you, it was difficult in the private industry to have women support women. Coming into the public sector, it is extremely different. It's a lot more supportive as women. You still get your pockets here and there, but what I have found is that when I ran for office in Mill Creek, oddly enough, I received a lot of donations from men, probably more men than I did women. I'm not saying that that's how you have to support women running. I did receive a lot of endorsements from women and men, but I had more inquiries from women about how am I going to run for office, work a full-time job, and be a single mom. Will I make time? And I'm here to tell you that if there's anyone who can hold office and multitask, it's a woman. It is a woman who will figure it out, show up the next day, probably tired, off 4 hours of sleep, and still get things put together. So what I would say, too, as we talk about finding spaces for solutions, we should, and this is my own personal perspective, is we should also be careful that we have more conversations with, if you want to call it across the aisle, with men, about how we can find common ways of addressing or calling someone out if there's an inappropriate statement that is made. I guess maybe what we don't know in the future and what the Me Too movement will look like in 10 years, what I don't want to see happen is that maybe our male counterparts will turn and lead in fear. They will turn and lead in fear and decide that although the men might be more qualified, it might be less liability for them. So for me, and what I would like to bring to you, and that is something it's been almost 2 years, I had gotten a job, and so I work for the state. I'm appointed to the Department of Administrative Services for the Board of Pardons and Parole. So I am, my equal counterparts are older white male in uniform and guns and had worked their way up a hierarchy. I have learned to work so well with them that the collaboration that we have and the communication and the open pathway, we have been able to find more solutions together, but I do realize the difficulty in how we move. So that's my experience, and thank you again.
I'll mention we were to have another person on the panel, and I just, this would have been Turner Bitten, and I'm just going to mention that he also, very much like Beb just mentioned, had a voice and a perspective about sort of having open and healthy conversations about sexuality and relationships, and also pointed to the fact that young men are going to be part of the solution. So I just wanted to add that particular idea to the conversation as well.
That's Cynthia Berg, Dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Science at the University of Utah. And thanks for tuning in to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Today we are airing a panel discussion from earlier this spring on the Me Too movement with a special focus on what's next for the movement. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a panel discussion recorded on April 5th at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, taking a look at the Me Too movement against sexual harassment and assault, and focusing especially on the future of the movement. Speaking on today's panel is Ella Myers, Associate Professor in Political Science and Gender Studies at the University of Utah, former Salt Lake Tribune editorial writer Michelle Quist, and Mill Creek City Councilwoman Bev Weepy. And moderating today's panel is Cynthia Berg, Dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Science and Professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Utah. In this next segment, the panel takes questions from the audience.
So now we're going to have the opportunity for the dialogue part of this conversation, where we are going to take comments from the audience, and then we'll have the panelists respond. So if we have a comment right here in front.
Hi, my name is Gabby Saunders, and I'm a political science major here at the University of Utah, and I'm in my senior year. This question actually is for you, Dr. Ms. Myers. My question for you then is, you did mention something about the due process when men are being accused, and I completely understand, you know, the want to get them out and get them not in a position of authority anymore where they can continue that abuse, but I've also had two men in my life that I'm very close with and respect that have been falsely accused, and it was devastating. So what is the balance between that? What are your thoughts?
That's a great question, thank you. Well, so I think it depends. I think we need to be clear about what kinds of context we're talking about, right? So due process is a constitutional guarantee that applies to government's treatment of its citizens, the guarantee of fair notice and fair hearing. It doesn't apply to employers apart from any process that is guaranteed by a private contract within that workplace. So I think, you know, there's different conversations to be had about criminal processes and about civil processes and work, you know, workplace settings versus others. I mean, what I was trying to suggest was that I think there's sometimes something a bit disingenuous about the invocation of due process. Not necessarily always, but if it's brought up in the context of, you know, a male professional of some kind who has, you know, been accused repeatedly of sexual misconduct, to sort of suddenly ask about due process when the women who have been dealing with this, you know, with this person for years, in many cases, have tried to report the conduct, have tried to find ways of dealing with it, and there was no concern about process when, you know, when they were confronting that situation. So I really was just sort of trying to just raise the issue that it might be worth shifting a little bit of our attention and concern away from men who are accused of wrongdoing and toward the countless numbers of women who have had their lives altered and in some cases effectively ruined by these experiences. And so I just want to resist our default tendency to preoccupy ourselves with men's needs.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Respond to the question.
Yeah, sure.
Your answer was great.
I'm so sorry that the men in your life were falsely accused. I can't imagine it would be awful. We need to remember that the rate of false claims in these instances is the same as any other crime. If somebody comes up to you, and it's between like 2 and 8%, if somebody comes up to you and says, oh my gosh, somebody stole my purse, do you say, are you sure? Are you sure you just didn't leave it? Like, your initial instinct is to believe the person that they stole your purse, because you had your purse and now you don't have your purse. In the case of due process, it's a standard of proof that we're talking about, that if you're in the courts, they have to meet this certain threshold to be labeled guilty. And like the professor said, that doesn't apply when we're believing women and we're just talking about a woman who comes up and claims she was assaulted or harassed, especially if there are multiple claims, and what you do in that instance. The thing that I keep hearing is that there's no evidence when the women say that a man did something to them. There is evidence. It's the woman saying that a man did something to them. Testimony is evidence. It is as good evidence as any other kind of evidence. You'll never have a video recording of something like this happening. I shouldn't say never. You will rarely have. And so we are able to weigh things when we hear them. And we can't just dismiss it by saying, well, there's no evidence that he really did that. If you're in a church context and you've had 6 or 7 or 8 young women complain about one leader, there's a problem there. They're not all making it up, and we don't need to wait for a police investigation to find him guilty to do anything.
So this is related to part two of your presentations, but what do you anticipate for backlash? You mentioned it, Michelle, with some of the legislators on the Hill saying, well, I'll just avoid the problem by not ever having a female intern. And so then you try to treat discrimination with increased discrimination. What do you see with the potential for backlash and solutions to that backlash?
I think there is a lot of backlash that women are experiencing. There's this idea that the more we talk about it, the more people will mute us, we'll dismiss the constant conversation about it. But the conversation is what's pivotal. And what we need there to make sure that doesn't happen or to support those that are speaking is for people to help, to speak up or to support women speaking up. We've had comments about how it's important that men be involved in this and support the movement and share their experiences, share maybe where they have, made mistakes in the past, or share maybe they were harassed before. Just the voice of men, ironically, is what's going to help this movement make a difference as opposed to all the other ones over the centuries that have been trying this problem.
So I guess maybe one of the things that I'm not sure would be a backlash is, so long as men are fear-driven in leadership, that maybe what we're experiencing now and not being given a chance to interview or things like that might get worse. And that's kind of on the fear-based leadership. For me, I feel that conversation, it is being able to say, that's not appropriate. I will tell you, I sat with a few guy friends in order to prepare for this. I just wanted to get their perspective of the Me Too, one very liberal and one very conservative with it. Both of them are extremely afraid to ask women out. So I don't know that the backlash only stops in the workplace, but giving a woman a compliment when you genuinely mean it should be okay. There's fear right now in not having a safe space for them to address what they've been raised around. The environment that they've been raised around has always been okay. But we have not said that here's a safe space for a conversation for us maybe to help you. And again, we mentioned that the Me Too may affect other men as well who've gone through experiences. I just watched an ESPN special about a woman who is heterosexual and played for a professional NBA team going through kind of a Me Too experience because she was not of the predominant sexual orientation of the team or really of the sport. So when I say we have to be cognizant of how much the Me Too movement affects people, again, there are different levels of who it affects. It's not just women. From men, it's women from women, men from other men. And so to have a better global perspective, I think for me, it's all about conversation and being able to come to the table and not create another divide.
I just wanted to say something in response to that. I agree with you that it's important not to lose sight of, the broad range of people who are affected by sexual harassment and sexual abuse. But I also don't want us to lose sight of the fact that the vast majority of people who suffer sexual abuse and sexual harassment are women. And even if we turn our attention to men who suffer abuse and harassment, it is primarily at the hands of other men. So men are the perpetrators, by and large, of sexual violence and harassment. And I think that's very hard to look at. I think it's very hard to acknowledge. I think that's also why there very often you sort of see what you're describing, which is men feeling very worried about how to conduct themselves, about whether they're implicated in this. But I think we need to face that. I don't think it's useful to sort of shy away from the fact that this is a problem that is primarily about masculinity in this culture.
That's Ella Myers, Associate Professor in Political Science and Gender Studies at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today, we are airing a panel discussion recorded on April 5th at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, taking a look at the Me Too movement and addressing what's next for the movement. In this final segment, the panel takes further questions from the audience.
So, Michelle, I am interested in what you had to say about the LDS Church, so if you could go ahead and elaborate on that as well, that'd be wonderful.
Sure. Let's turn the cameras off. I'm just kidding. So I wrote about what happened in the LDS Church, and if you aren't aware, just yesterday a woman filed suit. She's been known anonymously for a couple weeks now. She had an experience 30 years ago, a sexual assault in the missionary training center by the mission president. I apologize, I'm using Mormon language. I think you'll get it though. The mission president, again, stories differ as to what actually happened, but at the very least, the president admitted to very inappropriate conduct, asking to see her breasts and giving a frisky back rub to a separate missionary. So we see that it wasn't just this one young female missionary. The woman has tried to tell her story for 30 years by telling some bishops and some stake presidents. And we saw in Provo, one of the stake presidents, the former stake presidents admitted, or bishop, I don't remember, admitted that he just didn't believe her. And so he didn't do anything with that, with her comment, her plea. And what she was doing was she was asking for some accountability from him. She would call general headquarters of the church and ask, what has happened? Has there been any admonishment? Do you guys even know that I've made this claim? She went in 31, 32 years later, and she was talking to him. She recorded it, and he, made these admissions, and this was leaked by Mormon Leaks, and we've been bearing the consequences of this knowledge for the past little while. And I say bearing the consequences because it's devastating to know that the church's first instinct is to victimize the victim, is to come out with a dossier of her misdeeds and the fact that she didn't spend her whole mission on the mission. She left her mission early, and she's now, inactive, or she's not a member of the church. So I said in an article, we watched her leave the church over these troubles, and then we blamed her for it. I think that the church's initial response was not good enough. but I think they are seeing, I guess I should say, I hope they are seeing that that initial response was not good enough because it victimized the victim. It tried to say, you know, this she's awful. So it doesn't matter what he's admitted because look at her. You know, we need to make sure that in every environment, and especially here in Utah, in our churches, that young women are protected in church and that they can go and talk to a leader and be believed. And I guess that's what I hope the church has seen. And I think they are. They've made the improvements or the changes, or at least they've tried to educate more on the fact that these, you know, that interviews can be with, that someone else should be in the room. You know, there are kind of these obvious things that when you look at it now, it's like, oh yeah, that should have been happening before. You know, youth don't need to be in a room talking about sexual matters with older men. Somebody else, well, I was gonna say somebody else should be in there, but you guys probably might think they shouldn't do it anyway. I'm not gonna get into that. But yeah, there are these obvious things that the church needs to improve, and I think they're working on it.
What do you think would be the best way to start that dialogue within just the regular members of the LDS church, not necessarily leadership, but just teaching them to be vigilant and really starting that dialogue?
You know, I received a message over Twitter from a very well-known Utahn who is a stake president who said, thank you for speaking out. Can you tell me more about what we could do to help? And, you know, I told him the things, you know, the things that I've been saying here. We need to believe women. The criminal conduct, you know, threshold is not an issue. We don't wait for legal proceedings before we take action, you know, on a man who's received multiple complaints, you know, being released from leadership positions or things of that nature. So I think the answer is that the people that, who are talking about it need to keep talking about it. Parents of children, teenagers, stake leaders. I think as the generations of leadership positions move out and youngers or, you know, 40, 50-year-olds take the leadership positions in the church, I think those conversations are going to become more frequent, I hope.
Yes, hi, Mark Button, Department of Political Science. I wanted to invite the panelists to perhaps comment on what might be necessary at the level of institutions to think about the next stage of the Me Too movement. If we think, for example, about low-wage women workers, undocumented women, what needs to happen at the level of law, at the level of public institutions and organizations to be able to take the next step? For example, thinking about access to the courts might be one way to do it. I just wonder if you think there are some things at a broader societal level that we should be thinking about and maybe contributing to advance this movement.
Well, I will start with mentorship. I'm fortunate to have several mentors who are men, who are women, but I also wish I had that when I was an undergrad. I wasn't anywhere near here. I played ball, so my coach was my mentor, but I feel that had I had someone to go to while I was in this relationship many moons ago, I wish I had someone tell me what it looks like. How do you build your self-confidence? And self-confidence itself, just to say something's wrong, someone's doing something wrong, is still hard at any age. You can have a degree. Some of these issues of Me Too and domestic violence does not discriminate through socioeconomics. I never thought it'd happen to me. I grew up in Mill Creek, and things like that don't happen to people like me in Mill Creek. So I would encourage any type of mentorship. I know we have alumni groups that will reach out. Everyone has a story. Not all of them have come out, but everyone has a story. And I would want us to find spaces where we can encourage that. And it might not be in public spaces like this. It might just be that someone is willing to have a one-on-one conversation with a young lady or male that's here on campus and just doesn't know where to begin or how to process the thought process that they're experiencing. So that's one solution.
I think our institutions need to be more cognizant of racial and gender parity in leadership. I think we need to have more women and minorities in charge, or, you know, together. I think it, for instance, in our courts, our representation is we're very underrepresented, women and racials, even worse, as judges. As lawyers, we need to encourage pipelines from college to law schools or to business schools or to medical schools. You know, doctors make up leadership committees in hospitals. If there are no women doctors or racial minority doctors, then, you know, they've lost that voice in that realm. Every institution really can improve in this area. I think that's what we should be looking for.
Yeah, I want to second that. I think that's absolutely crucial. I mean, when I was talking earlier and trying to sort of share this idea of the fraternal social contract with all of you, I mean, I do think that that problem of presumed access to women is completely tethered to the problem of what is still the case, which is a near monopoly on political power held by men. And I think those things have to be pursued in common, and also professional power. So I think, like, for those of us up here on the panel, like, we all have a small foothold in professional worlds that are male dominated. And I do think for folks like us, and I would say for students and other faculty in the audience as well, if you have that foothold, you've got to use it to agitate for better representation of women, of people of color, of people with disabilities, all of the people who have historically been excluded from decision-making power in this country. And then the other thing I would just add is I do think a lot of this is about exposure, about getting these stories out there. And I am, like, heartened by the fact that I do think we're hearing more and more about the needs of women who are not part of these elite circles. So there's a lot more coverage recently. There's some great stuff you can look at. The Washington Post has done a great investigation into harassment and abuse in the restaurant industry. There's great work coming out of The Atlantic on abuse among farm workers. So there's lots of information that's starting to get shared, and I think that's really important. And there's also political organizing happening. There's an organization that has organized on behalf of women farm workers, has 700,000 members, and they recently wrote a public letter, announcing their solidarity with the Me Too movement more broadly. So I do think there's signs out there that the conversation is expanding and that the people who are participating in it is growing, and I think that's really exciting. I mean, I do think one thing that hasn't been mentioned that might be worth saying is, you know, some commentators have reflected on whether the Me Too movement is something that was sort of, or at least was one of its conditions of possibility, the Trump presidency, in the sense that some of the mobilization, if you look at the sort of timeline and the sequence of events, I heard Rebecca Traister, who is a brilliant commentator who's written some really great stuff on Me Too. I highly recommend her stuff if you haven't found it. She was sort of saying it's hard to know whether, for example, if Clinton had won the election, whether we would be seeing this right now, because, as with lots of political events, there's sort of an unpredictable confluence of factors that come together in a particular way. And so I do think, you know, it's an interesting question about whether the sort of the election of a known sexual predator to the presidency was also a spark that for at least some women in this country also helped them find their voice when another moment arose.
Even dumbed down, we're seeing the movement on, like, the TV show Rise. guys have seen that. It's kind of like Glee. But, you know, you see previews of the next show that shows the mom, the single mom who works in food, you know, has been slapped on the rear end by her boss, and she finally, or she says, no, you know, stop it, and hits him in the face. Part of it is seeing that there and recognizing it. But, again, that's speaking to the youth, and the youth already get it. So we need to find a way to move it beyond the youth to the 55 to 70-year-olds who are controlling business and politics right now, who feel like this whole movement has made it harder for men.
So you've mentioned a lot of, like, let's have a discussion and let's have a conversation, which I think is a great way, and I think that's how a lot of change happens. My question is how, and this is strictly from my perspective, I don't want to try to speak for an entire gender, but how do you do that with someone that doesn't seem to want to understand what you're saying? And so my example with that would be, Michelle, I was really touched when you talked about women parking under lights. And so I constantly live in this life where even if I want to take my trash out at midnight, I can't. I have to wait until the morning because it's not safe for me to go out to the dumpster by myself. And I was trying to explain that to a male friend, and he couldn't grasp it. And that's not to say that all males won't. He just couldn't. And I got so frustrated, and I want to just be like, you don't get it. So how do I continue to have that conversation with people? And instead of feeling that frustration, what are things that we can say to start those conversations so that we can have them and avoid getting into those situations of frustration and just kind of walking away?
That's a great question. Thank you, Madeline. I guess the first thing I wanted to say, this is a kind of sentiment. I don't even remember where I first encountered this idea, but it's very powerful to me, which is, like, I do believe that we should speak to people around us, people we encounter, people in our community, as sites of possibility, in the sense that, at least initially, we want to approach other people with the idea that we can actually have a meaningful exchange of ideas. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's going to be persuaded. It doesn't mean that every male friend of yours is going to have that sort of click for them, right? But I do actually believe that, you know, the best sort of starting point is to try to give others the benefit of the doubt and at least get things started. I don't think there is any guarantee ever in human relations, in dialogue, that we are necessarily going to persuade our interlocutor of the thing we hope to persuade them in of, but we have to at least try, and we have to at least be open to the possibility that, you know, over time, you know, it may not be in that conversation with your friend, but enough of those conversations from enough of people in his life might eventually prompt some movement on that front.
Because I'm a firm believer in this maybe tactic of conversation, I'll tell you the one thing for me is always a values-based conversation. If you don't know anything about motivational interviewing, look into it, because this actually helps you de-escalate any maybe heightened conversation that you might have. I, in this particular situation, safety was the value to you. And coming to a point where he can see that safety was the picture you were trying to paint for him, if you're not understanding his point of view, or if he is absolutely just rigid with not understanding why lights and keys and things like that are so important to you, I would ask him to tell you more about it. Tell me more about why you feel that way. Because if you dig a little bit deeper, there's a story that is going to come out of that conversation. I will also say that it's not just for me as a minority female, single mom, who lives in the most predominantly white district, most affluent district in our city. I think about why my son likes to wear hoodies. I guess this new style where they wear hoodies and it's half on your head, and he's growing a fro. That's part of his identity. I don't want to take that away from him and say, you need to dress like an upstanding citizen here, because he is. He's a good student. He's an athlete in our community. Our family has been there for over 35 years. So for me, the worry has always been, at least as a single mom, is what if someone doesn't know my son walking late at night? I've just recently this year allowed him to walk after dusk. Yes, it is 2018, but because of the heightened attention that we're getting, there's also how do I get people to understand my value system that really probably will align with yours. So my suggestion is a more values-based conversation, and utilize motivational interviewing as much as you can.
I would agree, personalize it. Always need to personalize it, whether it's his mother or sister or, you know, daughter, or your own. You know, I understand you don't understand, but I am afraid to go outside. You know, that conversation that brings it to you. And like the professor said, the people who are already talking about it need to keep talking about it. I am fully aware that my reputation and credibility as a writer, as a Republican, as a Utahn, you know, I get that reputation may be taking a hit because I keep talking about this one issue. But it's important to me, and I'm just going to keep talking about it.
We'll take one more question. That's great.
Hello, my name is Boam Choi. I'm a business management major, minor in political science. I just had questions for the panelists here about organizations. So we've talked a lot about being inclusive. We also talked about having a dialogue, a conversation. However, I don't know whether a conversation might go anywhere, and that's my biggest fear. So what I've seen, especially from the Harvard Review, I recently read that there's a decline with women in managerial roles. And we talked about mentorship. If there are no women to we can speak to as a woman, it's really hard to create that sort of mentorship. So do you think that organization should take some sort of affirmative action, try to take some sort of quota on hiring women at organizations? What sort of responsibilities should they take to make sure that more women are in these organizations?
You want to? I feel like I'm talking a lot.
You go for it.
I mean, I will say this is my opinion alone. I mean, I think, for example, the University of Utah does have an obligation to diversify its faculty and its student body. I have no problem saying that. It's a public institution. It should reflect the public it serves.
Yeah, it's an uncomfortable question. I get that. And you were nodding your head, no. I don't mean to. Oh, you're not? Okay, I misinterpreted. Men are gonna not like that idea. Or, you know, whatever the quota is against, they're gonna, well, I'm just as good. Utah State statute has a law that in the selection of judges, it says, after everything else is equal, or if everything is equal, we also want to take into account gender and or race. And just 2 years ago, one of the legislators tried to take that out, tried to change that, because it's the idea that somebody is going to be favored over another one was so offensive that, you know, he didn't like it. I won't go there. And that lost, that effort lost. It will never, men have been favored for so long, it will never go the other way equally. So, you know, let's just do it as much as we can and try to not even things out, but make sure that the population is represented as the population exists.
So I'm going to maybe touch on that in two capacities. Mill Creek has 3 out of our 4 council members are women. 2 are minority women. There's Councilwoman Sylvia Catton, who is a Latina, and myself, Pacific Islander. We have pushed for even hiring of women within the city. We're a brand new city. We're a year and a few months old. So starting a city, we have the opportunity to engage women to apply. our leadership that we've communicated to, the city manager we've hired, I would probably say it's a little even, close to maybe slightly on the more side of men, but we're a brand new city, so we don't have that many employees. In my work capacity, I think it's important to mentor really anyone who's willing to develop professionally. And sometimes it's not directly with me. It is they want to be supported in attending a leadership conference or a class that helps a specific skill set for them. I think being able to be part of the policymakers, which is where you're trying to get. You're trying to get into a place or you're trying to find women in a place that are open to it. If your organization is not open to it, I would encourage you to show some initiative and bring a great proposal to those who might take the idea a lot more so than maybe others in leadership if you are currently in an organization. But there are organizations that have women's leadership groups or cohorts that help each other out. We say mentorship. I am so blessed to have been an alumni here because I have great mentors here within the faculty and staff, two who are here currently. It's a matter of you might have to put yourself out there to find out what you want. Tell us what you want to do. We collectively here probably have a network for an organization that might align with your values and where you want to go in your career path. Does that answer your question? Maybe broadly? Sorry.
I think there's also the Women's Resource Center here and the University of Utah.
What I'm concerned about is that even with S&P 500, only 20% of women are sitting in the executive suite. And that's right? So the people at the top are men. And if we report these sexual assault, any sort of domestic violence, what are they going to do when there's no woman sitting at the top, no matter what sort of mentors we have? So maybe what I was thinking is with institutions, maybe we should have some sort of responsibility to make sure that we reach a certain level of women in these very high positions. Yes, you did partly answer.
You can always sell it from a financial perspective. The studies show when there are more women on boards, you know, approaching a parity, that the corporations earn more money. So use the argument that works in the environment you're in.
Great. I'm going to, in the interest of time, I'm going to ask the panelists to address sort of the question of really what is next? How can we all go forward to take some of these ideas to sort of the next step. So I'll have each one of them talk a little bit about that, and I think some of them would be interested if you have additional questions to remain after just for a few minutes. So we'll start with you, Bev. We'll go backwards and have some summing up questions.
Absolutely. I've mentioned a lot of this before. For those of you who came in late, I think we have an opportunity. I do want to give credit to what the professor has brought here. It is a problem. It is definitely a problem, and we should support, this problem of abuse or sexual assault comes about in our circles, and we should also support them as we see them through media, social media. I also want us to have foresight in the future as to how to have that, how to bridge. It's now a problem. How can we help make this problem minimize so that our children, again, I don't want to raise my son in fear of complimenting a woman, but I want him to understand that there are women, and he gets my story. He knows our story. So I want him to take that, be grounded in it, and also be a pillar for his generation when he sees something go wrong. It's difficult for teenagers right now. They're teenagers. They're navigating social media. I'm sure university students here are navigating social media as well. But really, communication is, I think, a huge piece in bridging. We have a problem. Let's do what we can to maybe not fix. I don't know that we can fix, but address it with the current maybe abusers of those who are coming out with Me Too, but also find ways to bridge gaps so that in the future we don't have male leadership that rule in fear. So, thank you.
I agree. We need to acknowledge the fact that the problem exists and we need to really examine our own culpability and our own belief system or ways of behaving that have contributed to Me Too. If you think about the fact that your mom, your sister, your wife experience sexual harassment at least once, often really, you can begin to understand the extent of the problem. And what you don't understand, though, until it happens to you, is how it affects you. The fear, and more surprisingly, the shame. Victims are shameful that somebody did something to them, and they don't speak up. And so I think the more we create, I know this is a word, the more we create safe spaces to talk about the movement, the better we will be as communities.
You all said such great things. I'm not really sure I have a lot to add. I would just want to echo what you had just said about the importance of continuing to talk and to not be cowed into silence and not intimidated in this moment, because I do think there's momentum building, and I think it is important that we build on that. One of my favorite commentators, Samantha Bee, did a show about the backlash against Me Too, and she commented on that show. She said, you know, now that we're finally listening to women, some folks are asking a very important question. Should we stop listening to women? And I think that is really sort of the moment we're at. I mean, it's funny and it's meant to, you know, to get us to laugh, but I do think that the challenge is to keep that going. And I want to say I'm very sympathetic to that last question we took about, like, the institutional barriers that seem to exist. You know, I agree with all of the, you know, and I've said it too, like, we need to talk about this, we need to publicize this, we need to have stronger mentor networks. All of that is true, but I get that sense that you were voicing about the feeling that there's just this, like, not intractable, but just this very profound shift that has to occur that has not yet occurred. And I am 100% with you on that. One thing I do want to say, and this builds on something you had mentioned, Bev, I do think, and I am not one of those, like, I believe the children are our future people, but I have a kid, and he is 5 years old, and he is already, as just part of his, like, regular daily life at school, learning about consent and bodily autonomy. It's nothing I'm doing, but he the other day, after we were talking about something, and he said, oh yeah, you know, it's really important to ask your friends if they want a hug or not. And if they don't want a hug, then you have to listen to them. And I mean, and that was just like, obviously he doesn't even know the word consent, but the sentiment of people have their own bodies and they have a right to bodily autonomy, that you, simply because you're a boy or because you've been raised in a particular masculinist ethos, do not have a right of access to, period. And then the other thing I would just say is I do think there's ways to get kind of like creative and just, I don't know, clever about the ways that we try to call out the problems that we're seeing. So this is just one little example, but most of the political scientists in this room who are professors and otherwise are members of the American Political Science Association, which is like our big professional group. And for the last couple years, I mean, this has been an endemic problem in the organization, which is they have this giant national conference, and very often there are panels with 4 or 5 people that are all men. And a couple years ago, somebody finally got the idea of just printing these really brightly colored flyers. It's just sort of like a guerrilla operation. They just like run around to the meeting rooms and leave these bright flyers on the table that say, congratulations, you're on an all-male panel. It's not gonna change the world tomorrow, but it's like, it's a clever way of drawing attention to a pervasive problem. And I just think we need to get kind of inventive and think about different ways to try to bring attention to this very deep-seated problem, so.
Great. I am going to end on a more positive note. So having been in the profession for many years, this is a very different conversation that we're having. We're having conversations like this with people in presidential positions, in dean positions, and it does make a difference. And so when people say things haven't changed, I say they really have, and that's a good thing. And I think all of us have to be part of that. So I am sort of on the positive level. I want to really thank our presenters. They were really terrific. I think they added a lot of insights. As you can see, these are pretty deep-rooted issues in sort of our intellectual history as a society, in terms of our politics, in terms of our socialization of our children. But I think we have really great leaders here that can lead us. And the great thing is it used to be that there was the all boys club. There's a very strong women's club, and so I think we don't have a name for it yet. It used to be the old boys, network, and old girls network sounds horrible. I think there really is a sense that we want to be mentoring other individuals. And so I think reaching out to people, it's the one thing that I almost never say no to, is a mentoring opportunity. So I think that's a really great thing. So I want to remind you to do the evaluation that our students have. I want to thank Mark Button for really organizing this series for the Hinckley Institute. Thank you so much as well. Morgan, and all of the students who have been engaged in this, and to the College of Social and Behavioral Science staff who has put a lot of this together. So thank you all.
That's Cynthia Berg, Dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Science at the University of Utah. You can find a full recording of this panel, which looked at the accomplishments and future of the Me Too movement, as well as other Hinckley forums, at our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your humble curator and producer of this program. Thank you for listening.